Okay, we'll bring the meeting to order if everybody would take their seat. And since we don't have a quorum, we won't do anything with the minutes yet.
I might as well go ahead with my bill.
What we'll do today is I'll begin with my presentation of House File 6, but we won't be acting on any amendments or the bill until we get a quorum.
And are you ready?
I'm ready, sir.
Yes.
Okay.
Just in case I'm here a while.
Representative Cornish, as previously mentioned, we don't have a quorum yet, so we'll just have a discussion of your bill.
Okay, committee members, Mr. Chair, committee members, today in front of you is House File 6. I'll be introducing later when we get a quorum on a delete all, the DE2. And why don't I begin with a little sensationalizing. No. When I thought about this, I was thinking about this bill the other day, and if you go into Joe's bar back home and you ask people what you should do with Crimsex 1 or sex offenders, you'll end up probably with a range anywhere from life without parole to castration to the death penalty. And I don't say that to sensationalize, but overwhelmingly the public expects us to do something drastic with the people we're talking about in these categories of sex offenses that are civilly committed. When I was sitting through the hearing the other day on the Office of Legislative Auditor, the civil commitment of sex offenders, a number of things came to mind and how to proceed. And I made some notes during the hearing, and so I'll discuss some of the problems or some of the points that came up at the hearing. The commitments have quadrupled in the last decade in Minnesota, the civil commitments, and they're expected to double in the next 10 years. When you look at the graph that the legislative auditor produced, it showed the commitments versus the available housing. And at a very near point in the future, they intersect, and the commitments go over what we have available for housing. The problem with that is that we're facing a huge decision point right now in that we're going to have to stick one heck of a lot of money into the sex offender program, which we already are, but in housing. And it's projected the number of commitments are going to go up again. The fact was, I think, double in the next 10 years. So it's inevitable. I mean, it's a foregone conclusion. There's no way to get around it. If we keep in the same process, we've got more people, and we're going to have to look at bonding bill and committing to a program that hasn't successfully graduated anybody yet. The one person they did violated, and a technical violation was sent back and ended up dying. Now, the MSOP's annual cost per offender is $120,000 a year. That's three times the cost of incarceration. Our commitment rate as a percentage of referrals varies drastically across the state. The statistical analysis suggests that some offenders are being committed may have a lower risk of recidivism than the others that are released from prison. The lower cost alternatives need to be considered for sex offenders being committed or ones already residing at MSOP facilities. So no one since 1994, when this was enacted, has graduated, except the one I talked about. Now, House File 6, with the eventual addition of DE2, well, moves closer to solving this problem. It doesn't solve it by any means, and there's still some questions to be answered, but instead of, like House File 1 did, just doubling the sex offender sentence in CrimSex 1 to double the sentence, this one talks about indeterminate sentencing, which some of you have heard about. Now, this isn't indeterminate sentencing with a parole board. This differs. It provides the authority to the commissioner upon release. But let me walk through some basic points here, and we'll get into more technical detail of what this bill does. Now, admittedly, this bill is also going to bring some controversy, but it's good controversy. It works at getting closer to solving the problem rather than just throwing out a doubling of the offense, because it has a huge fiscal note with it also, and we don't really solve the problem. It makes us feel good about locking people up, but it doesn't get near to solve the problem as much as House File with the DE2 amendment. Now, here's a walkthrough of the bill. Basically, this bill will address criminal sexual conduct in the first through the fourth degrees. It sets up a bifurcated trial, meaning a two-phase trial. Now, what this would do was the first phase of the trial is a penalty phase, and that would determine the innocence or guilt of the defendant. The second phase, once he's convicted and is now a criminal and is facing the sentence, now he would be classified, or she, as a possible predatory sex offender. Now, this designation is in subdivision 1 of the DE2. And we'll refer to the DE2. The definition of a predatory sex offender is found on the first page from 1.8 to 1.12. And a predatory sex offender under the DE2 House File 1 would be someone who is unable to control their person's sexual impulses, is dangerous to other persons, has a pattern of harmful sexual conduct, and harmful sexual conduct means sexual conduct that creates a substantial likelihood of serious physical or emotional harm to another. Now, if found guilty in this second phase of being a predatory sex offender, this person would be committed to the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections to serve a minimum of twice the presumptive sentence for this offense and a maximum of 60 years. Now, the good thing about it seems like where it's moving the direction of the auditor's report is we're possibly committing the wrong people, or at least we're committing people that aren't as dangerous as some of the others that are being released from the DOC. So what this would do is it would look at all of the stages and have to commit somebody and a second hearing. And this would help get the difference between the serious violent rape with penetration versus the person that is statutory rape, what they used to call it, when the suspect and the victim just age in years, and that's the biggest point of the offense. So it starts to sort out the seriousness and whether we really want to commit this person in one the scale or the other. They have to fall under certain criteria to commit. Now, after the minimum mandatory sentence is served, if the convicted person wants to be released under this conditional release, he must petition the Commissioner of Corrections. Now, once that petition is filed, the Commissioner has authority to conditionally release the predatory sex offender, but then see page 3 of your DE2 amendment, and you will see that the conditions of the release under this section, you can't be released from incarceration unless the commissioner is satisfied that this person no longer poses a threat to the public, is no longer in need of programming in a secure facility, is capable of reintegration with the general public, and the person seeking release has a burden of showing by clear and convincing evidence that the criteria in paragraph A have been met. Now, people will shoot holes in this theory too, and actually there'll be controversy. They'll say, well, is the Commissioner of Corrections really the right person to make this decision? Well, you could say the same thing about this three-judge panel in the Supreme Court, or you could say the same thing with a parole board or a single judge. Whoever you give this huge decision to probably is not going to want it. And there's certain advantages of certain people having it or not, whether it's Commissioner of Administration, the Commissioner of Corrections, a judge. Nobody is going to want to handle this hot potato. This was put out here as a solution because the commissioner already has authority to release people and makes decisions like this, but this would fall under the commissioner and whoever, whoever he wanted to get for advice, he or she, for this. Now, the conditions of release will be set by the Commissioner of Corrections, and the conditions of release would be you're not available for the condition of release until you've served twice the minimum mandatory. Now, once you've served twice the presumptive sentence, then you would be eligible for release, but in no case would that release be less than 10 years. And the release would be that the term of the release would be the difference in between time served and the 60-year sentence. And that basically is the bill. And it's, like I said, the civil, well, there's lots of other things we can do and that we will do, included in our committee's omnibus finance bill. I hope to have language in there about a study and a task force being put together. That's one of the things that when I asked the auditor about a task force on civil commitment of the sex offenders, and as usual, the task force, you folks have seen them that have been here for a while, there's boilerplate language and there's people you put on the task force. It's very easy to put together. And the studies are usually due January 15th of the next year and made available to the committee chairs, and then a decision would be able to be made. The reason why the task force is so integral and so important to this whole process is, like I said, we've got this huge decision to be made. We've got a bonding bill in front of us possibly for adding on to the sex offender prison, and or the sex offender treatment facility, I should say. Some would consider it a prison because nobody's been released, and that's one of the things we're trying to get at. And in this study, we're going to look at all sorts of things, and one of them will be a Texas study, that not a study, but an actual program that the legislative auditor talked about in Texas, where they release people like this to halfway houses, and they've got a record available of the releases already, and it shows a 0% recidivism rate. So naturally, there's no guarantee, and the risk we run, admittedly, is whoever this panel is of three people, a judge, a commissioner, whoever makes that big decision to release this person, and something goes bad, you know, the world's going to come crashing down on this person, this panel, or this judge. But it's really important that we do something, and that's why we varied from the original intention of House File 6, because House File 6 locks people up, but it does not get at the problem that the legislative auditor was talking about. So if we want to be logical and find a solution and move towards that ends and actually take a look at that intersection of civil commitments versus available housing, then we have to do something. And the House File 1 with the DE2 amendment is the first crack at it. And Mr. Chairman, if you want to call a quorum and add my amendment, that'd be great.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. And yeah, being that we have a quorum, first thing we need to do is approve the minutes. And Representative Leidiger, have you had a thorough review of the minutes?
Yes, I have. We'll move the minutes.
Okay. Representative Leidiger moves that the minutes be adopted for March 14th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay, the minutes are adopted. Representative Cornish, would you like to move House File 6?
Mr. Chair, it's House File 6. And I would like to move House File 6, put it in front of you, and then consider the DE2 amendment.
Okay.
Actually, the motion would be to House File 6 be recommended to pass and move to judiciary policy.
Okay, thank you, Representative Cornish. Would you like to discuss the DE2 amendment?
And to get the bill in the order that I would like it, I would also offer the DE2 amendment, which should be in the packet.
Okay. Representative Cornish moves amendment DE2 be considered by this committee to put the bill in the order in which you would like it. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the DE2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Okay, DE2 is adopted.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Chair, now that I've got the bill in the form, I'd like it with the DE2 amendment. It's up to you whether you want to take questions at this point, or there is people in, there are opposition and in favor of the bill behind me that would like to testify today.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. We will, let's take testimony first, and then we'll take a list of questions. So I believe that Sheriff Stanek, would you like to testify, Sheriff? Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. My name is Rich Stanek, Sheriff in Hennepin County. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for inviting me here this morning to speak on this important piece of legislation. I support increasing the penalties for criminal sexual conduct. These are the worst of the worst. You need to make, Mr. Chair, members, a good policy decision as well as weigh the cost and benefit of making a change like this in state statute, and what exactly those changes should be. I know you're going to work out through the rest of your deliberations this morning, but I'm here to tell you just a little bit about the effect of this legislation from the public safety side of it. You know, I've got 28 plus years of law enforcement experience here in Hennepin County. These criminals are the people that moms and dads want to make sure are locked up for a long, long time, and these folks are the ones we hear about from members of the community. They're afraid of them. Increasing the time these criminals spend behind bars is a good thing. This bill starts to get at that, and I applaud Representative Cornish for stepping forward and bringing it before the legislature here. Three bad things happen when the worst predatory sex offenders do not get the longest possible prison sentences. First, Mr. Chair, members, they get back on the streets and they force us to shake our heads when we read about repeat offenders. Secondly, they come to live in Hennepin County and a few other places around the state, as Representative Mulway and a number of folks from the Minneapolis delegation are keenly aware. Third, because they have such short sentences, they rapidly move beyond the regular supervision of a parole officer. I have here a document with pictures and criminal histories of no less than 106 level 3 sex offenders who are living in Hennepin County. It's quite a comprehensive packet, Mr. Chair and members. All of these folks are level 3 predatory sex offenders living in Hennepin County. Not all of them at home. Some of them are living on the streets because they are homeless. Over 80 of these folks, Mr. Chair, members, are repeat offenders, and over 60 of them have either finished their prison sentences or completed their supervised release periods and are no longer under a supervising agent. One of them is Douglas James Felix, who liked to attack teenage girls between the ages of 11 and 15. Now, he lives just a few blocks from my home in Maple Grove in the 9300 block of Ranchview Lane North. So it's both a professional piece as well as a personal piece for me. And many of these quick-release level 3 sex offenders have histories of attacks on children under the age of 5. Michael Banks attacked both boys and girls aged 4 to 14 years. His address should be in the state correctional facility, not in the 500 block of Penn Avenue North in Minneapolis. Irvin Bordeaux molested both boys and girls aged 13 and 14. His sentence was so short that he's no longer on supervised release, but he's living in the 2000 block of Glenwood Avenue North in Minneapolis. And Michael Dawson was released shortly after sexually attacking an adult woman. Then he got out after a short sentence for criminal sexual conduct against an 8-year-old girl, 8 years old. The parole officers can no longer check on him regularly at any addresses, both because the supervised release period is over and because he says he's homeless when he registers with us twice a year. And then there's the case of Robert Politano, a level 3 sex offender who moved from Hibbing, Minnesota to Hanover, Minnesota in Hennepin County in 2006. And from 2006 to 2010, Mr. Chair and members, a Hennepin County Sheriff's Detective submitted multiple cases against Politano for failure to register as a predatory offender. He was charged in 2009 and in 2010 for these crimes. In 2007, Politano was charged and eventually acquitted of criminal sexual conduct with a woman who was mentally impaired or helpless in Wright County. In 2009, Politano was arrested in Anoka County for first-degree drug sales. And finally, last August, Politano was convicted of drug possession and received a 3-year prison sentence. Well, he's back in prison, Mr. Chair and members, and honestly, from a public safety standpoint, we know he can't reoffend when he's back in prison. Now, these are the criminals that keep moms and dads up at night. They worry about the convicted offender who has served a sentence and is out on the streets, or in my case, living just down the street. They worry about the child being the next victim. And so again, I thank you, Representative Cornish, and members of this committee for at least having the deliberation today, hearing this important piece of legislation. I hope I was able to shed some light, at least from a public safety aspect of it. Mr. Chair, members, that concludes my testimony.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stanek. Mr. Freeman, would you also like to testify?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hilty.
I had a question for Sheriff Stanek before he leaves.
Okay. Sheriff Stanek, are you able to stay?
Sure. I can stay around for a little bit.
Okay. All right. Looks like we've got a couple of questions. Representative Hilty, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sheriff Stanek, it sounded like you were testifying more in favor of House File 6 as it was originally introduced rather than the DE2 amendment that was just adopted, which would provide for at least some people under some circumstances getting back out on the street earlier than House File 6 originally provided for. Have you had an opportunity to review the DE2 amendment, and are you supporting that the bill as it now stands, or where are you on that?
Mr. Stanek?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Hilty, you're correct. I was looking at House File 6 as a whole, but my comments, Representative Hilty and members, is maybe from a 30,000-foot view from public safety in my years on the street. I support being very tough on predatory sex offenders in our communities. I know what damage and havoc they wreak on the streets. As I said, I've got this packet of 106 folks who live just in Hennepin County. If this body decides that the DE2 amendment serves its needs, so be it. But I've not had a chance to read the DE2 amendment at length, but rather I support it more from a global 30,000-foot view.
Representative Hilty, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sheriff Stanek, Representative Cornish mentioned one of the things that was mentioned in the legislative auditor's report that both he and I were able to attend last Friday, and that was the experience that they've had in the state of Texas, in which offenders actually are controlled, let me say, in halfway houses and by other means than just being incarcerated. Are you familiar with the program in Texas?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, Representative Hilty, I am not familiar with that program. I'm sorry.
And before we continue, Representative Hilty, Mr. Diebel, do you have some insight here that might be helpful?
Mr. Chair and members, I just point out that under the DE2 amendment, the if you're convicted of a predatory, found to be a predatory sex offender, the presumptive sentence would be double. So for criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, it would be 288 months. And as proposed in House File 6, as introduced, it was 300 months. So although it wouldn't apply across the board to criminal sexual conduct, it would double that presumptive sentence.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornish?
Thank the staff for that comment, because in the statement you made it less time. Actually, this could be more time because they aren't available to release. Would that be in like 25 years?
Mr. Diebel?
Mr. Chair, yeah, just under 25 years.
Before they're considered to be released would be 25 years, and then it would be a conditional release of a 10-year conditional release, and that's just before they're considered 25 years. Currently, they were considered before that. The program originated in 1994. And they were already released one that didn't work out, and they're considering release another. So actually, I think this is just as tough on the release, and we still have to have a decision made. It's not an automatic release, so I think it's just as tough as the current system.
Okay. Representative Hilty, do you have further follow-up?
Not at this time.
Representative Gaultier?
My question goes to the bill itself, so I'll wait for it.
Okay. Thank you. We'll leave you on the list.
The chair,
thank you, Sheriff. Thank you. Mr. Freeman? And please state your name for the record, please.
I will, and thank you. I'm Mike Freeman, the Hennepin County Attorney, and also appearing today as the president of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, it's nice to be back in the legislature. Thank you. The county attorneys are concerned about protecting public safety through all of the procedures and processes we have, doing it fairly and justly. We have the criminal justice system for people who commit violent acts and criminal sexual acts, and then we have the civil commitment process. And right now we have a process where many people receive a sentence in the criminal justice system, but before they're really prepared to return to society, they're civilly committed and sent to hospitals, both in Moose Lake and St. Peter, trying to work, help them work through the problems they have. I appreciate very much Chairman Cornish bringing House File 6, and I've had an opportunity to look at his Delete All Amendment. I think he has some excellent concepts in this Delete All Amendment. Expanding the sentences that will be covered under his bill from just first criminal sexual misconduct, the first degree, to second, third, and fourth degrees. Using a release authority, which is similar to but critically different than a parole board, is important. And we have some suggestions and pledge to work with the chairman on this. Let me share a little bit of our vision. Sheriff Stanek has set forth the problem. We know it's a very serious problem. There are very serious situations here. But as president of the County Attorneys Association, I've already convened a working group of experienced prosecutors who want to examine this bill and this issue from a global point of view. I've read, it took quite a while, but I read the legislative auditor's report that was presented to you. The legislative auditor has raised some really critical points. Some of those points have been well known long before they completed their work. We know that Minnesota has one of the largest numbers of committed, civilly committed offenders in the country. We know that, unfortunately, treatment to date, even over a 10-year period of time, has not really provided the kind of protection to where people feel comfortable about releasing these individuals back into society. We know that the cost to have folks in hospitals versus incarcerated is three times the cost. And at a difficult time for finances for all this, that's a serious manifestation. What we want to do to assist you in your difficult task is to come up with a more cost-efficient system. We want one that has greater uniformity. We want to work with you to be able to ascertain as best we can the folks who really deserve to be off the streets for a long period of time and the people who don't. And frankly, there are people today in our state hospitals who probably don't have to be there. The problem is this is not a neat little definition that we can say A equals B. This is human beings, and we can't get inside their heads, and even medical technology doesn't enable us to predict without fail. And when we fail or make a mistake, the consequences are severe. We think the system has got to be more effective. Released offenders who violate the supervised release need to be easily and quickly returned to prison, not to hospitals. And we need to encourage treatment. Our suggestion, broadly in a concept, is to take these most serious sex offenders and move them out of the determinate sentencing, where they have a 10-year sentence, they meet that 10-year sentence, they're released, semi-supervised probation, to an indeterminate process, which means, in essence, they will be held in a prison facility until they can show us they're ready to return to society. There's a number of reasons for it. Frankly, it's a little bit more transparent. It's a little bit more honest, if you will, because a lot of these people are simply not able to, nor should they get out at all. But in prison, it's a lot cheaper. We need to enhance the kinds of treatment these individuals can. There are numbers of people who can be released from prison and will benefit from our hospitals, which are very good hospitals. But we civilly commit bunches of folks that don't get in the criminal justice system first, and they need to be in those hospitals as well. So, in short, what we think, the system that we envision is one that creates indeterminate sentences for a group of the most violent predators, and particularly the repeat predators, the ones again and again. And that could be a person third or fourth degree crim sex, not the most violent crimes. Thankfully, they didn't have an opportunity to commit those most serious crimes, but they are serial predators. They are people who simply can't be on our streets unless there's major work done to make them better. So, in conclusion, Mr. Chairman and members, I appreciate the Chairman Cornish taking on this very tough topic. We do need longer sentences for some of these people. I think we need comprehensive reform. We are prepared to work on a task force with you, and I've been on a number of them. I helped to create a couple, and I've served in a couple, and they don't always work. But this one, its time has come. We need to take a comprehensive look at this. In the meantime, Mr. Chairman, we're happy to work with you wherever we can with our experience as the people who not only prosecute these predators for their criminal wrongdoings, but civilly commit them. And let me just say on the civil commitment side, it is an excellent process. It is a thoughtful process. In the criminal process, it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt, as it should be. We have no problem with that standard. We're taking a person's liberty away, and they've committed an act that justifies it. We should meet that standard. But in the civil commitment process, sometimes folks have not committed a crime yet. We're taking their liberty away as well. The standard is clear and convincing evidence. It's a little less than beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's a high standard because we're taking their liberty away. This is a good system. We're protecting people from themselves and others from them. But in the sexual predator world, we're a little out of sync. We're out of balance. And we're willing and prepared, Mr. Chairman, to spend time working with you and the committee on this. I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Freeman, and also thank you for reminding some of our members that there is life after the legislature as well. So welcome back.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson, do you have a question for Mr. Freeman?
No. Mr. Freeman, thank you, Mr. Chair. One question I have is with respect to the jury determining whether someone's a predatory offender as opposed to a professional risk assessment approach. What are your thoughts on that? How would that actually work, and is that the best public policy way to proceed on this?
Mr. Freeman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, that's a thoughtful question. I'll do my best to try to answer it. In the criminal justice system, we have to prove all the elements of an offense. For example, if we prove someone commits a homicide, and we believe they also did it for the benefit of a gang, we have to prove not only that they killed someone, but they did it for the benefit of the gang. So having additional things we have to prove in the criminal justice system is not unusual. The more things we have to prove, and the less clearly they're defined, the more difficult it is. Exactly what a predatory offender challenges us for definition. You know, you all can make a definition, and we can think about it, and we can prove it if we need to. I think one of the reasons that I think the County Attorneys Association and those folks who work in this all the time favor the indeterminate sentence, because we'll do that at a criminal trial, one criminal trial, like we do, okay? And we will have to prove the elements of criminal sexual misconduct in the first degree, and there may be a component like predatory that we'll have to prove there. Then the person goes to prison. Then, Chairman Cornish has a lot of these criteria and procedures in his bill. Then, after a period of time, this person says, well, you know, I'm better, I've had this treatment, and wants to convince the review board that they are. Meanwhile, that person's in a prison at less cost than in a hospital, although they should be receiving some treatment, and society is protected. I think it's a little bit more transparent. It's not the perfect word, but transparent as well.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson?
Not necessarily to that question, but a different one. Will county attorneys still be able to proceed with civil commitments then on sex offenders or predatory sex offenders, or what is the implication for that process?
Mr. Freeman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, yes, under existing law, if the cases are brought to us, and they're usually brought to us by a medical professional who has made the initial determination that this person is of danger to themselves or others, we can initiate the commitment process. But where, and that's longstanding, and it's a pretty good process. I think it's pretty fair, and it's pretty cost efficient. Where that civil commitment process got overwhelmed, frankly, and let's call it like it is, after the Drew Shadeen case, all of us were concerned that other people like him would come out. And so therefore, all of the people who are sex offenders virtually coming out of prison were sent to the civil commitment process. The number of civil commitment lawyers in Hennepin County Attorney's Office doubled. Our cases almost tripled. We had to review all of these cases, and we should, you know, under the situation. That's not quite what that system set up to do. So we kind of dropped it, something else. So the short answer, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, is the civil commitment process will remain. Sex offenders will continue to be part of that. But the most serious of the sex offenders won't be accessing the civil commitment process. They'll be in the criminal justice system with an indeterminate sentence seeking treatment to prove that they should get out.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Freeman, we've been touching on what I'm interested in pursuing here. With indeterminate sentencing, as you said, it would fall upon the offender to somehow prove or demonstrate that they were capable of being released. That presumes, I guess, that there would be, I mean, how would you prove that? You know, if you have a treatment program in prison, I think one of the problems that we've had with that is that, well, let me back up a minute. One of the things that that was pointed out in the legislative auditor's report about the sex offender program as it exists currently is that it really was insufficient time devoted to treatment. These people that are committed to the program. It's difficult for me to envision a situation in which there would be more time capable of being devoted to treatment to someone who's in the prison system. So how would a person in prison under these circumstances be capable of convincing anyone that they should be released?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, again, a thoughtful question. I'm going to try to do the best I can. The first part of your question was, is this unfair to the person for them to try to present the case that they ought to be released back into society? In essence, our present system puts that burden upon the individual. They have to go through treatment. They have to convince medical professionals that they have responded to the treatment and they're prepared to do that, and they have to convince the special review board or the commissioner. So that isn't different. What is different is having the treatment in a prison at one-third the cost. It also acknowledges, and this is a difficult statement for me to make, but I think it is true. This acknowledges that there, frankly, are simply some people whose illness is so profound that society cannot permit them to return. And they'll be kept in a prison for the rest of their life. I think we're going to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff more quickly. I think we'll do it more profoundly, and we'll certainly do it with less cost. Now, we will still need hospitals for some of the civilly committed. There may well be cases in which a person who has been in prison needs some specialized treatment and can get it. But instead of sending large numbers of sexual predators, some of whom probably don't need the elongated process that presently exists, we're going to try to get the folks who are least ill out more quickly, and those that are really sick and don't deserve to get out, they'll stay in, but they'll stay in a prison. That's our goal. Now, getting there, stating the goal is a lot easier than getting there. I acknowledge Representative Hilty.
Representative Cornish, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, one thing I think that was uncovered in the legislative auditor's report is these people are never cured. Nobody says that they're cured when they're released, and basically, in layman's terms, it's just a best educated guess when they release them. That's all they can do. It's a guess whether this person is going to reoffend. You take all the wealth of knowledge you got and the experts and then throw a scientific wild guess. I'll leave that one word out. And also the treatment that they receive, there really isn't a bar of treatment they receive. They just have to receive treatment. I think it's kind of a vague term as to the Supreme Court challenge, and so that's what we're worried about. And the sex offenders in DOC currently all have a sexual treatment program. But and I think the reason that mentioned it in the auditor's report, they qualified the lack of therapy that they were getting or classes. A lot of it was financial. They're unable to fill the positions of therapists. So it amounts more that not the lack of treatment in treatment hours, maybe in that sense, but the lack of instructors or therapists or counselors, whatever you call these folks that deal with these people. So. So it's a work in progress, the whole thing, and it ends up, unfortunately, to be a guess. But that's the one thing nice about a long rate of incarceration, and that's what the prison folks are saying even, is that the longer we keep them in, the more of the time we have to look at them, because a lot of these people lie and deceive for a living, especially in the sexual predator field. You'll find this more pervasive, I think, than a lot of the offenses. So that's why long incarceration is good. The 25 years, they get all that time to look at them and try to sort out with their best guess who is really giving them the business as far as their true feelings and whether they're, you know, the rehab, able to be rehabbed or not.
Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, we heard the same thing, and I agree with your summary of that. But there's a couple of things. Realistically, I think what we're talking about here is basically giving anybody that would be committed under these circumstances a life sentence, because it's very difficult to see how they would be able to demonstrate that they should be released into society. And I agree that there are some people that are currently incarcerated that absolutely shouldn't be. But Representative Cornish, you just pointed out, and I think we all understand from the testimony of people involved in these programs, that this is always a question of relative risk, that no one has ever changed so completely that any of these issues disappear from their personality. So it just seems to me that it's very difficult to envision a circumstance in which anyone would be comfortable just saying, okay, we think this risk is sufficiently diminished that we're willing to put this person on the street, which I think is why we haven't seen that happen. But there's kind of a contradiction here also, in that Mr. Freeman has said, you have said, I have said, there are probably some people that have been committed, civilly committed to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program that really shouldn't be there. But even those people haven't been able to demonstrate that they shouldn't be there sufficiently to cause them to be deemed eligible for release. Kind of suggests that there's a problem here. Once you get in the system, it sounds like it's pretty much impossible to get back out.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, I agree. And don't get me wrong, I actually would favor locking them up for life if finances didn't push us into it. The main crux of this bill is we can't afford to do what we're doing. But I would argue that actually the language we've used for conditional release criteria is, I think, boilerplate language already from somewhere else. we're not really making it any stricter. What we're doing is applying the same criteria, only at a local level. And the advantage of this bill is that you do separate out the really on the sieve of the worst of the worst. I think the advantage of this is you get away from the statutory rape, and a certain thing from degrees of 1, 2, 3, and 4 isn't really the criteria you look at. The criteria you look at is if they meet, you know, these three or four sentences to meet that bar where you are a sexual predator. So you sort out and you put the worst ones away, and therefore you refine the system so you're really getting at the bad people. And you use basically the same criteria. And some of them shouldn't be released. We have to admit that this Ryberg guy is going to be released, possibly. We really don't know if he should be. And so we do need a strict criteria to keep these folks in. But the nice thing about this bill is you're more sure these people are like Ryberg rather than the guy that had relations with a juvenile and ended up marrying her, who might be on the other end of the scale, but maybe shouldn't be locked up like a Ryberg. So I think that's what this bill moves in the direction. And I won't put words in Representative Paymar's mouth because he isn't here, but he was also looking at a model similar to this, as is Judge Neuville, who used to be a senator, had actually a proposal much similar to this. So so we're trying to come in that direction. It isn't perfect by any means. So.
Representative McDonald, and just a reminder that we're 45 minutes in, and we certainly want to get to a few more testifiers. So, not an admonishment on you, Representative McDonald, but just a reminder.
Very good. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I will be very quick. Question for Mr. Freeman. I was speaking to our Wright County prosecutor attorney just this weekend regarding this topic, and although I would agree with Representative Cornish that perhaps locking them up for a very long sentence is the best, certainly, after doing months of research and listening that they never really recover and or never really are treated properly. So the prosecutor for Wright County was telling me that the complications in having a longer sentence is that they won't negotiate a shorter sentence in the before trial, and it'll go to trial, and the cost, of course, that is expensive, but also the fact that there's a possibility, according to law, that they will be freed because you have a sympathetic jury that might acquit them, and then that predator's out on the street, even a more harm to society. And I just will read real quickly, according to the OLA's audit, and maybe I'm reading this incorrectly, but it says that Minnesota allows hearsay evidence and requires the commitment standard to be met with a clear and convincing evidence rather than proving beyond a reasonable doubt. So I'm just sharing with what my county prosecutor shared with me. I'm no expert by any means, but I'm finding out a lot that they never really are cured. So I'll reiterate the fact that the possibility goes to jury. A sympathetic jury says they acquit him, he's out on the street, and it's a bigger harm to the public. With that said, I'll end closing saying I do support, because it's less expensive and it's more appropriate to lock them up for a longer period of time. So therefore, I do support Representative Cornish's bill.
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, you do have a fine prosecutor in Wright County. And many prosecutors, including me, have said, and I heard it said when I was sitting behind your chairs, when you get sentences real long, society's protected for a long period of time, but it makes our job more difficult. Every life sentence that you have, every sentence that you increase, means you have that concept, regardless of the crime, did the person really deserve this long a period of time? Now, we have said, as a society, and you have said as a legislature, and I'll be part of that too, that people who commit premeditated murder are sentenced to life, some without a possibility of parole. You can argue whether that's good or not, but we know that person's off the street for that period of time. Does it make our job harder? Yeah. Would some of those people deserve to be off the street for the rest of their lives? Yeah. And so I'm not concerned about that. With the discussions of Chairman Cornish's bill about elongating those sentences and having the procedure he talked about, or even what I've talked about, indeterminate sentences. I think we have to select the folks that we want this treatment to be, and the best we can, we want to select that for the worst of the worst. And then it's our job, which is what you've entrusted us to do. And, you know, frankly, if you look at this, The prosecutors in the state of Minnesota have a success rate of in excess of 90%. 90%. These sex crimes are tough, and first-degree homicides are tough, but there are people who have committed bad crimes against society, and that's why you pay us with tax dollars, or our county boards assess property taxes to pay us to do our job.
Representative Grunhagen.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Freeman. And Tony, thanks for bringing this bill forward. I'll make my comments brief, but just a couple things about this study group that I'd comment on that's going to be done. I hope you hear testimony from the victims, okay, about the scars they carry through their life based on the attack or what's been done to them, okay? When I look at us spending $328 a day, or about $120,000 a year, on these level three sex offenders, it's disconcerting to me that, as far as I understand, we spend little or nothing on the victims, okay? And then we're spending this money, and I agree with Representative Cornish and other people who've commented, they aren't curable, okay? So just another suggestion, look at hard, sweat, wet work rather than so-called therapy, where you sit in a session, get in touch with your feelings, look back in your past, and try to blame everybody else for your behavior. It's time they accept responsibility for their behavior and put them out there working hard. That's a better therapy. Put the therapist right next to them, by the way. And that's a better therapy than sitting in some session, looking inside yourself, getting in touch with feelings. That doesn't cure hardly anything, okay? That's just a recommendation when you look at this study. Okay, other than that, I got a few other comments, but I'll restrain myself.
Representative Gauthier, do you have a question for the county attorney?
Yes, thank you. Actually, Chair Cornish, I want to go back to the second phase of trial. First of all, thanks for bringing this bill. Are you comfortable with the jury determining who is a predatory offender versus an expert?
Mr. Freeman, or Representative Cornish?
I've really never trusted experts.
Why am I not surprised?
I would much rather hear, I would much rather trust the guy that owns Joe's Bait Shop to make a decision about sexual predator than I would an expert, I guess. I have not been very impressed with experts. And just a little elongation of that, back to Mr. Ryberg that's going to be released. All of the experts have said that this guy is the best candidate for release, but not to sensationalize, he raped a woman in front of her husband, and he admits he's not cured, and admits he has disturbing sexual fantasies. So, and you know what I'm getting at. So who is the best person to make the decision if they're never really cured, I guess? And plus, we put in the standard beyond a reasonable doubt, which I would think would make some attorneys happy because... and I'm not talking about the prosecutors, but if you put them to this criteria beyond a reasonable doubt, you're pretty assured, I imagine, with the instructions, you get jury instructions, that this person is more likely going to be a lot more dangerous sexual predator than somebody on the other end of the scale. So I'm very comfortable with the jury making the decision. Sorry for the long answer.
Mr. Chair. And if we can just limit to one more follow-up so we can get the testifiers. Thank you.
Well, I'll comment and follow up then. First of all, Representative Grunhagen, I don't think when we are dealing with these people, we ask them how they feel. And I, as a therapist, I find that offensive. I think what we try to do is get inside their heads and figure out where they are. And I would agree with Representative Cornish. It's an art, it's not a science, and you don't always do that. But one of the concerns I also have is that the legislative audit talks about not enough treatment, and now I'm okay with moving these folks to prison. Don't get me wrong, because I'm going to vote for this bill. But I think we just create another hurdle of getting trained experts in there to do what we need to do. We can't even find them now. And I'll tell you, when I look at work opportunities, I strike out Department of Corrections because I don't want to go into a prison. And I think there's a lot of therapists that do that. So that's just a concern I have. And is there any thought to how we can overcome that hurdle?
Representative Cornish or Mr. Freeman?
Either one of you.
Did you understand the question? I mean, I understood the whole point, but the basic crux of the question, if you could rephrase it just shortly.
Well, I'm saying we're not getting enough treatment because we don't have enough people. Mm-hmm. And one of the barriers I think this bill creates is now we're putting it behind bars in a prison, that people aren't going to want to work there. And quite frankly, I'm not sure that I understand why anybody would want to work with these folks, but there are people that do that. So how do we overcome that additional barrier of recruiting people?
You know, I don't know that. I can see with the field they're working in. I've got a nephew that works closely in the program, and all I can guess is that the working conditions must be horrible there, and that maybe that's some of the reason they aren't getting enough people in those slots. But actually, I think probably having been in St. Peter and seen that facility myself, I would much rather work in a prison than I would one of those facilities, so maybe prison would be a better work atmosphere.
Representative Moran, do you have a question for Mr. Freeman?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, because I don't know much about the statutes, and can you tell me, either of you tell me, what is the worst of a predatory offender? What would that look like, the worst? Because I hear you saying the worst of the worst. So what would the worst of the worst look like?
Representative Cornish?
Oh, just the worst.
Well, I'd hate to describe that in open public meeting, actually, but you see, the determination and the worst of the worst under the DE2 wouldn't matter if it was crim sex 1 or on the high degree or crim sex 4. It would matter the criteria. So the worst of the worst in this bill is a person, regardless of what criminal sexual conduct degree they're convicted of. The worst of the worst is somebody that's unable to control their sexual impulses, dangerous to other persons, pattern of harmful sexual conduct, meaning that conduct that creates a substantial likelihood of serious physical or emotional harm to another. That's the worst of the worst under House File 6 as amended by DE2, regardless of the sexual degree.
Representative Moran, we do want to get to a few more testifiers, so okay. Let me do one more follow-up.
Two questions.
Okay, make them all at the same time. Okay. How's that?
The worst of the worst could be anyone who commits any kind of sexual offense. Because I think what we also heard from testimonies from others before is that, and I don't know if that's a level 1, a level 2, a level 3, or doesn't make any difference, is that most sex offenders, 90% of sex offenders could be, you know, your uncle or your brother or priest who only commit that offense once. Most do not reoffend. So I'm just trying to see where we can get a balance of those that we are doubling that offense for, incarcerating them for not 10 years or 12 years, but 25 years now. And we had good testimony here that stated that most do not reoffend.
I'll take a quick thing in, and then I'll give the county attorney here the rest of it. But I would guess, and maybe the county attorney could tell me, I doubt if you're going to go to the second phase of the bifurcated trial with somebody that doesn't meet that criteria. So if you've got one of the persons described, it's not a very serious sexual offense and it's only committed once, they're not going to go to the second phase of the trial because they have no way of meeting that criteria. But the county attorney could.
Yeah. And Chairman Cornish, Mr. Chairman, Chairman Representative Moran, I think the chairman has aptly said it. I would have a very hard time proving the person is utterly unable to control their sexual impulses if they committed one act. There are cases which you could, which were so vile, you perhaps could do it, but that's very unlikely. Most of these folks have multiple offenses. Most of these people have preyed on children or young adults or vulnerable adults. Most of these people, we have to display a pattern of conduct over a period of time. I don't think any of us want to have a significant number of folks incarcerated for this. What we want to do is protect society against repeat offenders. Pretty hard against the first-timers, and we don't have anticipatory incarceration, thank the Lord. But we can tell because these folks are going to have to do it again and again or do it in horrendous ways. Because I can't prove it otherwise, so that's why we have a proof system in this country.
Representative Hilty, is this a question for Mr. Freeman?
I just wanted to make a brief follow-up to Representative Gauthier's question to Chair Cornish, and that is on the assumption that a jury somehow would be more likely to be able to make a determination about whether someone was I'm blanking on the term, but a sex offender that should be committed to this sentencing. And that is that one thing that we know about sex offenders is that there is a certain class of them that are very adept at lying, at misrepresenting themselves. And I don't think that the assumption that somehow a jury would be better able to ferret that out than a trained professional is necessarily in every case the best.
Okay. Can I see a show of hands of anybody in the audience that would like to testify in favor of the bill? Okay. Anyone who's here to testify in opposition to the bill? Okay. We'll go ahead and hear the opposition testimony. And please state your name for the record, Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is John Stewart. I'm the state public defender. I also was a member of Governor Pawlenty's Governor's Commission on Sex Offenders in 2005 and 2006. That commission recommended an indeterminate sentencing approach, and so I really commend Chairman Cornish on taking this turn with his bill. I believe, and most people that work in the system believe, that an indeterminate sentencing approach is the way to go, some version of that. In the long run, I believe it will be more fair and it will save money. However, I want to comment on a couple of concerns. First of all, Mr. Chair and members, there will be a period when this won't be saving money because the effective date has to be for crimes in the future. So somebody that committed a crime in 2010, for instance, and is in prison now serving 144 months, that person has to go all the way through the pipeline under the old system and has to go through the commitment process because you can't go back and put this additional prison time on them. So for at least 8 years, there will not be the total cost savings that you might be visualizing. Secondly, Mr. Chair and members, there are some elements in here that would represent a cost transfer from the counties to the state because the counties pay for the representation of people who are alleged to be sexually dangerous persons and sexual psychopaths right now. And to the extent that this bill would make that part of the criminal trial, then the public defender system, which you fund, would be taking on that responsibility. So there are going to be some issues of cost transfers back and forth in this. And these are expensive cases because of the scientific issues that are involved on both sides. Finally, Mr. Chair and members, to answer the questions about the jury trial, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Blakely about 10 years ago, ruled that any time that you have an aggravating factor for a sentence that would make a person spend more time in prison, the prosecution has to prove that aggravating factor to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. The reason you don't have a jury trial in the commitment cases right now is that they're not leading to a prison sentence. They're leading to something that's called a hospital. But if you're putting the people in prison, they're really, you know, and I respect Chair Cornish's commitment to due process of law, but in any case, you have to give the person a jury trial on the issue that has given them twice as long of a prison sentence.
Are there any questions from the members for Mr. Stewart? Okay, thank you, Mr. Stewart, for your testimony. Is there any discussion, further discussion from the members on the bill? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Cornish, the cost will apparently over the long run save the state money, but given how budgets are more kind of vertical and corrections has its own budget, what would be the cost to the Department of Corrections to this? Have you got any numbers on that yet? One of my concerns, just to continue as you think about that, is that I've seen over the years is that we pass bills out of here without paying for them. I want to make sure that you know, we got the money in our budget to cover these important bills.
Representative Cornish.
I think that we've just decided to take all costs out of the public defender's budget. Just kidding. What I don't really know. That's why I think while we're continuous on the judiciary policy and finance. And Mr. Carter, did you have any comments about the fiscal note?
Mr. Carter?
Members and Representative Johnson, we did pull up the fiscal note from the Neville bill that was from the 2004 session, and there are the costs are the Supreme Court had the first year over $3 million for increased trials, juries and things like that. Public Defense Board had a cost the first year of $438,000, and then the Corrections Department also had some costs in there.
Representative Johnson?
Well, just to comment, I mean, those kind of costs are the price we pay for a society where we want to live in, but I just think we need to make sure we pay for those costs and not, not just push it along without making sure we're accounted for.
Representative Maury?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I have to comment, it's a great coffee mug you have there this morning, and I think it reflects a great week after Saturday night's game.
You mentioned it, Representative Mulry. Yes, it was a very good game on Saturday.
Yes. That's right. There's somebody from close to Hermantown. Representative Chair Cornish, as someone who's worked on this sex offender since my second term here a lot, as I've said, we have to get smart on crime, not stupid tough on crime. And I think I noticed you're not wearing your Wyatt Earp outfit today, and so I'm glad to see that you're moving more toward the reform of the criminal system in line with the treatment and being tough when we have to be, and recognizing what works and what doesn't work. And I think this is a big step towards that. I know that Jerry Madden, who I know he's chair of one of the crime committees in the Texas legislature, and he's considered them just about the most conservative Republican down there. And he's a leader on reform, both on juvenile justice and on adult. And I think we have to look at this, and I know you're working on a study task force, as I am. I'm not sure that this is the perfect bill, but it's a lot better than where it was. And I think maybe you might want to consider, I guess we could. I was thinking of an effective date a year from now, so that we would have the study group in case we needed to change anything. But I guess we could possibly do that anyhow, based on the study group. I think that possibly for some of the people this might be too long in incarceration, but the thing that's really good is the indeterminate, and that we can determine that later. I do disagree with you on thinking that a jury and seeing somebody for a few hours can determine better whether they might reoffend than somebody who's an expert working with them for a few years. But I think those are all things we can work with as we progress on this. I think it's a very good first step to be looking at the new evidence on what works and what doesn't work. So I'm glad to be working with you on going ahead on this new type of reform, looking at these legislative issues on how to really be effective on crime.
Well, thank you, Representative Mulgrew.
And that bipartisan note, is there any further discussion? Okay, would you like to renew your motion, Representative Cornish?
Yeah, I'd like to renew a motion of House File 6 as amended and be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee Policy Finance.
Right. Representative Cornish renews his motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay. It's passed. House File 6. And will be referred to the Judiciary Committee. Next, we have Chairman Smith's bill, House File 439.
Representative Smith, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I'd like to move House File 439, that it be recommended to pass, and that before you take a vote, that it be laid over for possible inclusion in your bill.
Okay. Representative Smith, the bill is before us. You can go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chairman and members, this bill seeks to amend Minnesota Statute 609.2232 by adding three words, the word shall, and then the words not concurrently. The statute was passed in 1997. There's a fiscal note in your, in our committee packet. This bill was brought to me by the previous corrections, Commissioner of Corrections. And the plain fact is that some of the assaults by inmates on correctional guards in Ramsey County, the court simply has not been following the law. The original bill was passed in 1997. The intent of the legislature was that when an assault occurred in a correctional facility, that the inmate, upon prosecution and conviction for the second assault, that the, any time that would be imposed by the court would be, were to be running consecutively, not concurrently. The fact is that in some of the cases, the courts were simply ignoring the legislative intent, ignoring the statute, and imposing the time concurrently. As a result, under the column of "we told you once, we're going to tell you again" to the courts, we're adding the words "shall run consecutively" and not concurrently. The fiscal note in the packet was a fiscal note was considered by the legislature in 1997, so any costs that the fiscal note suggests has already been covered in 1997 and is included in their baseline. So I would argue simple truth that there should be no cost, there should be no cost to this, in as much as the legislature in 1997 considered that. That's it.
Okay, Representative Smith, any questions so far from members? Is there anyone here to testify in favor or opposition of the bill? Okay, seeing public testimony is closed, any comments? Representative Smith, we'd like to renew your motion. Or do you want this held over for possible inclusion, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if you'd lay it over, please.
Okay, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, Representative Kelly, and would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I'd like to move House File 447 to be passed and referred to Judiciary.
Okay, House File 447 is before us for consideration, and you can begin your testimony however you would like to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and first of all, I'd like to thank the majority of you who signed on to this bill. The maltreatment of vulnerable adults is a serious issue, and what this bill does is strengthens the act in a couple of different ways. Mr. Chair, we're going to only speak to those that are under the purview of this committee, which would be Section 2, a registration requirement, and Sections 7 and 8. And I will have Ms. Freeman go through a quick general definition of the bill, and then we'll move forward.
All right.
Welcome. If you could state your name and title, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Iris Freeman, of a different Freeman family from the Hennepin County Prosecutor. For better or worse, it's different. I am Associate Director of the Center for Elder Justice and Policy at William Mitchell College of Law. My professional training, however, is in social work, and I've worked in vulnerable adult services and policy for 35 years. I will provide the background this morning, and then Sergeant Wortman will testify on the portions of the bill that are in focus today. This bill comes to the committee, and thank you, Representative Kelly, from the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project. The Vulnerable Adult Justice Project is a collaboration of associations, agencies, and viewpoints who come together to safeguard and advocate for vulnerable adults. I hope you have a topical summary in your packets. On the second page, you'll find a roster of the health, human services, law enforcement, and public agencies who come together as part of this project. We have our agreements, we have our disagreements, and House File 447 represents our common ground for this session. In the year 2009, we had a successful initiative to combat financial exploitation of vulnerable adults, and we're very proud of that work. As a starting point, Whom does Minnesota law define as a vulnerable adult? Many states have laws that are laws intended to prevent elder abuse, and they're simple matters of 65 or over or 60 or over or an age classification. Minnesota has a more complex definition of the people we seek to protect. First, they're the people who receive certain kinds of services, like nursing home care, licensed home care, those in care facilities for adults with developmental disabilities. These are people who are vulnerable adults categorically. By category, they are vulnerable because of where they live or the services they receive. There's a second definition as well, and that is others who have two characteristics: impairments that get in the way of their basic daily needs, and who, on top of that, also have impaired ability to protect themselves from maltreatment. That is the functional definition. So there are many changes that are made in House File 447 to safeguard vulnerable adults in ways other than via the criminal code. But let me just, in the interest of time, name three. First, for cases that aren't investigated as crimes, but as individual needs for protective services or their regulatory issues, we clarify the jurisdictions of the various public agencies and use more up-to-date terminology so cases will get routed more accurately from the county call-in centers. That is protective to the victim. Second, we strengthen the administrative review panel that responds to situations where the vulnerable adult or their representative feels that a case wasn't fully investigated and that they're not being protective. The panel that oversees those complaints and concerns is strengthened. And finally, we add information protection and a voice for the vulnerable adult when their caregiver appeals a finding of abuse, neglect, or exploitation. either to a Department of Human Services judge or to an administrative law judge. In those kinds of appeals, House File 447 establishes a means for the vulnerable adult or their guardian or their health care agent to submit information, very much like a victim impact statement, that will be considered by the judge in the appeal hearing. And the agencies that substantiated the abuse or neglect or exploitation are also encouraged to seek testimony from the vulnerable adult as a witness. So with that background, I want to thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As Representative Kelly said, many of you have supported the bill with your signatures, and I'll be glad to answer background questions now or turn the microphone over to Sergeant Wortman. And I should also mention there are a number of resource people from public agencies here in the hearing room today for questions that are in their areas. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. We have a question from Representative Mullen. What?
Mr. Chairman, I'll let the witness go first.
Okay. On the next witness, go ahead and state your name and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Mike Wortman. I'm a sergeant with the St. Paul Police Department. I head up the new established unit within our department that investigates crimes against the elderly and vulnerable adults. Here's why we started this special unit. In 2007, our department, along with several other city agencies like the St. Paul City Attorney's Office, St. Paul Intervention Project, received a grant from the Office of Violence Against Women and the U.S. Department of Justice to develop a training team that would go about and be certified as trainers for law enforcement officers throughout the state in the dynamics of dealing with elder abuse and vulnerable abuse cases. I am one of the members of that training team. With the number of our citizens reaching the age of 65 growing at an alarming rate, our department realized the need for a special unit that specializes in only the victims over the age of 65 and vulnerable adults. Our unit right now is averaging over 50 cases a month coming into our office to be investigated. There are two changes to House File number 447 which would make in the criminal code. The first is in Section 2. The criminal abuse of a vulnerable adult in current law includes sexual contact with or penetration of facility resident, patient, or client by a caregiver or service provider employed by that facility. That law was passed in 1995 and came after a lot of hard work that was done on the Predatory Offender Registry in the early 90s. House File 447 would make that crime a registrable offense to conform with the treatment of comparable cases. This behavior is one where the victim is relying on the abuser for daily help. The power differential and ways to intimidate are right there all the time. Today there are multiple sex cases that relate to power differentials in employment settings. Psychotherapists and their clients, clergy and counseling situations, special transportation drivers, just to name a few. These crimes require registration, and so should the crime when it's perpetrated by a facility staff person on a vulnerable adult. The second change is in Section 7 and 8. We standardize the penalty for assault of a vulnerable adult at a gross misdemeanor. Current law is a gross misdemeanor for defined caregivers, while other assailants who know or have reason to know the vulnerability of the victim face lesser penalties. We even that up. When someone like a neighbor is targeting that vulnerable adult, they should face the same charges. One case to illustrate that point is that I investigated a case several months ago with one of our many snowstorms. A vulnerable adult with developmentally delayed was out shoveling her sidewalk. Her neighbor, knowing full well that she was a developmentally delayed individual and considered a vulnerable adult, watched her shovel the sidewalk, and she just threw snow onto his sidewalk. He went out, slapped her in the face, and shoved her into a snowbank. Knowing that her vulnerability was in question, he didn't attack her. He attacked that vulnerability. I want to thank you for paying attention to the needs of these vulnerable adults. one day each of us are going to come to rely on these protections, and unfortunately some of us sooner or later, sooner than others, and that's me.
Me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members.
Thank you, Sergeant. And now a question from Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess it's probably for Mr. Diebel. It's got to be your area since Becky isn't here. My question is, I believe this adds to the level of assault, and I guess what I'm concerned of, and I go back quite a while on this, and working with vulnerable adults, I was on the elder law section. I actually was one of their two volunteer lobbyists before I got elected, and was one of the six attorneys from the private sector that was on the Attorney General's original panel for the first Vulnerable Adults Act. And there are a few distinctions. In other words, what I'm thinking of is generally assault if, let's say, the chairman, John, is walking and the chairman puts his arm and prevents him from going, let's say, that could be an assault, or yelling at him could be an assault in most cases, I believe, if it was enough that somebody believed it was intimidating. On the other hand, if John has severe Alzheimer's, and he's nodding that he does, but in that case, the chairman is trying to prevent him from leaving where he could harm himself, either through putting his arm on him or talking to him in a loud way, which there's some evidence, quite a bit of evidence, that shows that that's one way to get through, if there's any way to get through to an Alzheimer's or a severely certain types of incompetent. And what I'm concerned at is I don't want the person who's actually trying to prevent them from harming themselves or possibly causing harm to themselves to be guilty of an assault in the same way that if they did it to you or I.
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, members, my response would be I'd draw your attention to 609.02 subdivision 10. It defines assault, and that's an act done with intent to cause fear in another of immediate bodily harm or death, or the intentional infliction of or attempt to inflict bodily harm upon another. Furthermore, in the bill, Section 7 requires demonstrable bodily harm, which isn't defined in statute, although bodily harm is. Bodily harm is defined as means physical pain or injury, illness, or any impairment of physical condition. I believe case law defines demonstrable bodily harm. I've forgotten the exact phrase, but it's basically a bruise or some sort of obvious indication of harm that resulted from the assault. So does that provide any clarification?
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Diebel, maybe I'm confusing it with civil assault, possibly. But in any case, Representative Kelly, your intent would be to exclude if the person in the description that I did, if Chairman Cornish was actually doing it to try and prevent him from, prevent John from getting into harm's way or something, you wouldn't be trying to get him included with this assault, would you?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly.
Representative Mullery, I believe Mr. Diebel said it correctly. I mean, definition in statute 609.02 defines assault specifically for this bill.
Okay. Representative Mullery?
Mr. Chair, I think that it's probably okay. I'll look into it later with Mr. Diebel.
Okay, thank you, Representative Mullery. Anybody else on the list? Okay. Any testimony in support or opposition to this bill in the crowd? Seeing none. Any more comments from members? Questions? Seeing none, would you like to renew your motion? You'd like to renew your motion, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to renew my motion to pass House File 447 and refer it to Judiciary.
Okay, recommend to pass and move to Judiciary. Everybody heard the motion. Any discussion from members? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, bill passed. Thank you very much, Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, testifiers.
Thank you, Chair and members.
You got anything else?
Thank you.
Any more questions or comments? Tomorrow at 10:15, next meeting adjourned.